So let's look now at the content just to prepare you for your own reading and then next week's reflections on it. The content. The ideas against which the author writes were widespread in the Hellenistic world. Many writers attempted to counter them as they were judged to undermine religion. One of the main movements judged responsible for the irreligious teaching that you'll find mentioned in our letter was that of the Epicureans, who considered that pleasure was the main goal in living and that religion as a whole was an obstacle to people's attaining maximum pleasure. Don't misunderstand Epicureanism, though. They weren't advocating living a life without discipline. Quite the contrary. For experience soon teaches anyone that lack of discipline does not lead to sustainable pleasure. You only have to live to know that. Nor did these Epicureans deny the existence of a divine realm. Their argument, and by the way, this is very modern, it's quite relevant to today, their argument was that if the gods, I'm talking about the pagan Greek world, if the gods were to live in bliss, they couldn't afford to be distracted by human good or evil, or have the duty to reward one and punish the other. They were quite an intelligent group of people, these. In any case, so they argued, it's so obvious that evil often prospers that it's folly to assume that there's a rational order behind the universe as we experience it. Things are the way they are. Things happen by chance or in a random fashion, not by a divinely ordained pattern. The best we can do is seek to be happy and to live in a way that is as free from fear as possible. They considered thoughts of an afterlife to be a distraction, as also claims to prophecy. Seeking rewards and attempting to avoid punishment can only result in fear and anxiety. Yeah, so a reasonable man or woman in the first century could well have been very attracted to Epicureanism, especially when faced with religions, whether pagan or, if not careful, Jewish, read the Old Testament carefully, religions that generally worked on the irrational assumption that God controls the world. And God punishes and God rewards. If that's your image of the world, if everything that happens in the world is God's will, if that's a religious perception, a rational person with openness, has got to reject that. I mean, I can help you reject it in a minute if it's still lingering in your mind. If I, for example, I'll say I, but I mean you and me too, if I'm open to God, if I'm listening, if I'm humble, if I'm praying in the Spirit, and I speak or act or do something, you can quite rightly draw the conclusion that what I'm doing is God's will. You know, it's a simple statement, but it's coming from God. Okay, so if you've got an openness to God, you can say, oh, God's will is being done by Francis of Assisi or Mother Teresa or whoever it might be, because the person is acting out of prayer. Fair enough? If, however, I am not listening, not obeying, not acting under inspiration, but quite deliberately acting against it, and I do something, what I'm doing is called sin. And sin is defined as acting against the will of God. So what I'm doing cannot be said to be the will of God, for heaven's sake. It's not God's will that I'm doing. I'm doing something else because I'm free, and God lives with this freedom that he's given me, because if I'm not free to do evil, I'm not free to do good. I'm just a machine. Whereas he's got this, granted we're free, we're capable of freely loving, generosity, and all the beautiful things that make up human life. We wouldn't be without them. But if I'm free and God respects my freedom and I act against God's will, anyone who says, oh, well, it's God's will being done because I've butchered somebody or because I've behaved terribly or because I've caused adultery or because of whatever, I say, oh, well, it's God's will. For heaven's sake, we've all got to say, get your brain in order, mate. Look at what's going on. And so when we look at the crucifixion of Jesus on the cross, to take a perfect example of it, it depends where you look, whether you see God's will being done. If you look at Pilate, Herod, Judas, the soldiers, the priest saying, come down from the cross, the thief that's cursing, and you're not seeing God's will being done. You're seeing sin rampant on the hill of Calvary. If, however, we look at Jesus, that's where we've got to look. We see God's will being done there, in the one who, in that sinful place which is not God's will, in that place of murder, injustice, innocence being condemned, that's what we're watching. Well, don't let's just say, oh, it's God's will. God's will is that Jesus be crucified. For crying out loud, what are you talking about? God's will is sin, mortal sin, evil? Now, wait a minute. Where is God's? God's will is that Jesus give his life, even in that awful situation which we can be in too. Even in that terrible situation, God's will is that we love. And Jesus remains prayerful, trusting, forgiving, gentle, caring on the cross. That's where we see God. And the centurion who looked at him said, wow, this is the Son of God. Because as Mark says, he saw how Jesus died. Not that he died. It doesn't save anybody. How he died, now you're talking. Now you're into something. Now you're seeing God revealed as love, not as crucifying. Well, that's obvious. I think it needs saying, no? So the Epicureans, living in a world where people were too readily looking into the entrails of birds or watching the wind and looking, sacrificing their daughters, Iphigenia, to the god for the wind to blow them to Troy and all this stuff, they looked at it and they had the brains to say, cut it out. But they didn't have Jesus to help them see where we can see God in love given unto death. So no wonder they did the next best thing. They became quite sceptical of all that. Leave it out, and the best thing you can do is try and be happy and make other people as happy as you can. And as I've said, all that which is not written, isn't that pretty modern for so many of our world who are sick to death of religions? And they're getting sicker of religions as they see them in the public area. And the preachers and the Don, and God being called on too readily to fly into towers or to bomb Iraq or to do whatever, you know, or to stand for the dollar or to run around our parliament. And like, they get sick of it. So thank God we've got Jesus to give us an alternative to Epicureanism. But Epicureanism, maybe that's the best you can get without Jesus. So that was what was current in the day, that kind of thinking. And Peter, Simeon Peter, the Christians were saying to their world, no, wait a minute, there is a way of seeing God here. God is love, and there is something you can do. And it's not just rationalism that's going to run the world, and it's not just happiness at the surface that you can see. There's a deeper happiness. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the pure of heart. You know, there are ways of becoming a saint in this world through grace and prayer and all the rest of it. So that's the Christian message. And we're seeing it in Jesus. And we're seeing it then in the martyrs and so on. So, to go on now, back to our text. There's abundant evidence of the presence of these and related ideas in the Roman and Greek worlds of the first century of our era. That they were also known in the Jewish world is also clear, as is indicated in the following Aramaic Targum of the Cain-Abel narrative of Genesis 4. We're fortunate to have this. The Bible is there. Okay. The Bible is written in Hebrew. But Hebrew was not spoken, a bit like Latin today, or maybe for many, few generations. Hebrew was the old written sacred text. But after the exile, the lingua franca, if I can use that word, of this part of the world was Aramaic. the language of Syria, Aram. And that was a much more flexible language to do with selling and buying and life, and it was a bigger language. And the people of Jesus' day didn't speak Hebrew. They could well read it the way you could learn Latin at school, and it's a Semitic language. They're cognate, so there's a lot of parallels, but not the same. They spoke Aramaic. So from the pulpits of the day, they would read the sacred text in Hebrew. That's the sacred language. Then the rabbi, or whoever it was, would then explicate the text orally in Aramaic. And targums are the written sermons of the day, if you could call it that way, where they spin out the story and add to it and look into it and reflect on it. Well, we've got an Aramaic targum of this Cain and Abel story, and this is how it reads. And let's just put in the text, like the scriptural text, not exactly translated into Aramaic. It's not, you can't translate the sacred text, but written in Aramaic, but also embellished in Aramaic. I know that the world was not created by love, that it is not governed according to the fruit of good deeds. There is no judgment, this is Cain talking, there is no judge, there's no other world, there's no gift or good reward for the just, no punishment for the wicked. Jewish Epicureanism in the text. Of course, the text will go on to counter that, but that's the view there. So it is to protect the Christian community against such a set of ideas that this treatise is written. On its own, this is not an argument against Peter, the leader of the apostles, being the real author. However, the nature of the heretical ideas is such that its scholars find it difficult to imagine these ideas troubling first-generation converts, since these ideas undermine teachings as basic as the resurrection of Jesus. So it looks like a trouble in the community that has got a little distant from Jesus' death and resurrection and has actually been open to much more influence from the Greek world. It looks like an end of the century or beginning second century world of ideas rather than an enthusiastic new group so sure of the resurrection of Jesus. These ideas, they would have just given them shove off very quickly. I hope you can follow the logic, and there are some of the other arguments why scholars pretty well unanimously now say, no, you're dealing with a pseudonymous writing. The author appears to be prophesying the coming of errors which are going to trouble his readers at a future time. We should probably work on the assumption that they are actually already troubling the community, and that our anonymous author is writing in Peter's name to highlight for his readers the apostolic tradition which these errors are undermining. He chooses to write in Peter's name not only because of Peter's leading role among the apostles, but also because prophecy and revelation are at the heart of the problems which he's addressing. And the gospel record frequently presents Peter as the subject of special revelations. One thinks of Peter's recognition of Jesus as the Messiah at Caesarea Philippi, to which Jesus replies, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." Matthew 16:17. One thinks of the transfiguration in the following chapter, which is explicitly recalled in this letter. Peter was among those to whom Jesus had foretold the advent of false prophets in Matthew 24, in the eschatological discourse, something that's also mentioned here in chapter 2 of our letter. Jesus revealed to Peter also the matter of the parousia, you find that in Matthew 24, and that judgment would come like a thief in the night. And these matters are central to the argument of our letter in chapter 3. According to Matthew's account, it was in response to a remark by Peter that Jesus spoke about the renewal of all things. chapter 19 of Matthew. The author wishes to speak of this as well. So that's the content. It's only preparatory for you. When you read it yourself, see if it's making sense to you. And then, you don't really need this, but I'll share it for you. Our earliest manuscripts of this actual document, 2 Peter was known to Origen in the early 3rd century. The oldest complete manuscript copy is that papyrus from about the year 300 AD. Early in the 4th century, Eusebius includes it, along with the letter of Jude, as among, brackets, the disputed books. So in the year 300, that's in the history of the church, book 3, chapter 25, paragraph 3 of that book of Eusebius, he says that in the church it's still disputed. It's included in the 4th century parchment codexes of Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, and in the 5th century parchment of Codex Alexandrinus. Then this follows the structure of the letter that might help you in your reading, and its use, though as you can see it's quite minimal, only on 4 days, 2 Sundays, or the Feast of the Transfiguration, 1 Sunday, and 2 weekdays in the whole of the church's 3-year cycle, does this letter appear. But it does, and it's at the edge of the New Testament, but it's still, I hope you find, with its own beauty.